Hey, man. Did you touch my drum set?
Nope.
It's just weird, because seems like someone definitely touched my drum set.
Yeah, that is weird. Because I didn't touch them.
Well, hello and welcome, everybody. This is the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode 30.
Woo!
In what has now become a long and drawn-out series, we've got a very, very special show for you today. Very cool guy is joining us that we've been talking to for a little bit now, and he seems very enthused to be here. He's very happy. He's smiling right now. Mr. Sean Nelson will be joining us in just a moment. But first, what I'd like to talk about, of course, oh god, and I totally forgot. This is the show that drops bombs of awesome into your ear holes. Welcome, welcome, thanks for joining us. Episode 30, I never thought it would get this far, and it probably shouldn't have.
Are you
have.
Off your fucking meds
but,
or something?
But your emails are, and everybody, you know, signing onto our Facebook page and things like that, thank you very much for all the kind words. And now, you know, we're available on iTunes, so please try to rate us or write a review, bad or good. We just need something up there. But I've been noticing this trend. Every time we have a guest, like somebody of any type of importance over to our house, you know, we clean everything up, we clean the litter box out, and then our cat goes in there and just prepares an explosive, hellish deuce that just makes the whole place just smell so bad. And, you know, I've been trying not to talk about poop so much on this podcast, but it never works because poop is just a part of all of our lives, and we need to talk about it sometimes. So, yeah, that's I was a little bit stressed out, you know, before Sean got here. We were cleaning up, we were making everything nice, so we didn't look like pigs living in a sty. And then our cat Titus just drops this load, and we had to make everything smell better. And so, luckily, he has a cold, so he probably can't smell anything right now. So anyway, let's bring him on, Mr. Sean Nelson. Thank you so much for joining me here today.
What is that stench? Hi. It's true, I have a cold, I can't tell. And your house is very clean, it puts my own house to shame.
Well, it's not usually like this, I will say that right now. We we did some due diligence this morning.
D-O-O, diligence.
I'm a joke
that's
maker.
That's right. And made things look pretty for you. So, thank you so much for coming on. It's an honor to have you here. When I first emailed you and asked you to come on the show, I was not very nervous. And
nor was I.
I wouldn't expect you to be. And then, to do some research, you know, like a fake reporter would, mm-hmm. He would sign on to your Wikipedia page and look at your sordid career. I guess that's not really the right word.
Sordid?
Sordid.
S-O-R-D-I-D. Or assorted.
Assorted.
Oh, yeah.
Sorted
is actually more correct, I think.
But so I'm looking at your Wikipedia page, and I'm seeing all this stuff that you've done in your life and your career.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, shit, this guy's for real. Like,
Wikipedia is notoriously inaccurate.
Right. So did you actually ever beat those charges?
Do you mean, when you say charges, do you mean the kids I was tasked with taking care of? There were no charges. No. All I know about my Wikipedia page is that the photograph on there is really unfortunate, and so I haven't looked at it.
How come?
Past
I'm
that.
Looking at I'm looking at it right now.
I just here. I didn't like it.
You didn't like that one?
No,
side
profile is always a bad idea with me.
It is, yeah, with me too, and mostly, and that's why I grew like the beard.
Yeah, I tried that.
Yeah, I'm just like totally hiding my double chin.
It's a false economy.
Yeah, right.
Growing a beard to hide your appearance, because really you're still under there. And also my beard
That's
isn't
true.
That full, and it basically connects, but it's also really red, ginger, as people like to say now. And so that's, someone told me that I looked like a 6.5 foot tall leprechaun.
Really?
Yeah.
You are a very tall man. I was not expecting that.
That's true. Taller than any leprechaun.
That's that damn sure. Damn straight. So how was your Christmas? Did you have good holidays?
I did. I had a perfectly fine Christmas. Normally, Christmas is a season of loneliness and despair for me. But this year, it was nice. It was fine. I saw some family. I went to a grown-up party on Christmas night.
Those are always fun.
I guess I've just reached the age now that I'm in my early 70s where everybody I know basically is married and has kids. And
right.
I went to a party full of people who were married and had kids, but I had a great time because they were all really smart and funny, and I didn't really know them. I only knew the hosts. My friends Ed and Mel had this, you know, it was just nice to kind of be around people instead of sort of socked away in my lonely room, which is what I normally do for Christmas.
Well, at least, and I have to pull this card. At least you did not have to work for Christmas.
That's true. That is very true.
I had to. It was there.
It's all right.
Right.
All right. I'm glad anyone remembers that song.
Of course.
That's one of my favorite things that Harvey Danger ever did.
Right. Does your family live out here, or
Sort of have two families. My mother and stepfather live in Nashville, and my father and stepmother now live in Bothell, Washington, which is about 20 miles north of Seattle. Mm-hmm. They just moved back earlier. Well, I guess about a year ago. And so I was in Bothell for Christmas Eve.
Right on.
And I was in Nashville for Thanksgiving.
Yeah. And how was your New Year's Eve? Are you a drinker?
I am not I'm not like a heroic drinker, but I do occasionally have a drink. I had a nice time. I went to Portland and I went with some friends, and it was also a grown-up party, and it was also full of people I didn't know, except for, you know, the people I was with. And it was nice, you know, it was just sort of civilized and hopeful and optimistic, and I had a good time. And Portland is, you know, obviously a utopia, and so it was nice to kind of be there.
Yeah.
And imbibe in the utopian vibe.
The Bohemian Rhapsody, if you will.
Yes.
Yeah. We had a good New Year's Eve. We went out with some friends and went over to our friend Jess's place, and then ended up going home at 12:01.
Yeah. Right at the stroke of midnight, the people who were throwing this party in Portland, somebody changed the music from like slow jams to this very horrendous dance music, contemporary dance music mix, and so my companion and I left about 5 minutes into that. So yeah, we were definitely gone by about 12:15.
No longer your scene.
Well, it's just, you know, some music is innocuous and in the background, and some music is great and you can't help but make it the foreground. And some music is so terrible that you have to leave.
Yeah,
and, that's for sure.
Well, let's since we're talking about music now, that was a perfect segue.
Amazing.
Yeah.
How do you do it?
It was like that wasn't even scripted.
Unbelievable.
It was amazing.
I'm just proud to be a part of it. Proud to be a part of this number, as Jim Morrison memorably improvised.
Right. So how did you? Let's kind of go back. Take us back in the Sean Nelson hot tub time machine, if you will.
Oh, God.
And take us back. How did you first get involved with music?
Well, I sang in choirs in junior high school and high school. Not that cool. Although the one choir I was in did perform Billy Joel's "It's Still Rock and Roll to Me," so I guess wasn't entirely lame.
Choirs aren't really lame anymore. You know, with all these shows that are coming out, like the a cappella show.
Yeah.
That's on. I don't know. What is that on? Channel 5.
Studio audience for the taping of that show.
Really?
Yeah, oddly enough.
The one where it's Ben Folds is like the...
I was sitting right behind Ben Folds. Someone I know has a relative who's one of the producers of it.
Oh, wow.
So I went, and I also turned out that I knew someone who was like one of the music supervisors of it. Anyway, I'm here to tell you that I think that it was very lame.
Oh, really?
And in fact, it is super lame now, and it was devastatingly lame then, but at least it was under the radar then. Like, mm-hmm. it wasn't like there was anyone... people probably weren't laboring under the delusion that choir was cool then.
Right,
but
right.
We really enjoyed doing it. And as it turned out, yeah. It was great musical training. The only musical training I ever had, which is probably not massively surprising. But it was really it was really useful and really enjoyable and really innocent and free from all perception that it was cool. Whereas now people think it's cool, and they're wrong. You know, they have added indignity of being incorrect and having delusions. So I don't know. You know, I've never seen Glee, although I did.
Right.
I watched about 5 minutes.
I think that's the extent that I've seen it too. Yeah, and they put a hell of a spin on Choir Kids, don't they?
I only saw the first few minutes, and it did well. I mean, obviously, being young now is nothing like it was in my day. You know,
but right, right.
In the '80s, there was. I mean, I don't know. There wasn't much in the way of what I would identify now as coolness in the suburban Southern California kind of milieu that I grew up in. but I can tell you for sure that singing in choirs was not part of it.
It was not, yeah.
But then
it wasn't the cool kids hangout.
No, not at all. I mean, it was for, there are so many different kinds of dork in the world. And
right.
And
right.
If you are temperamentally or genetically a dork, as I unquestionably am, you have to sort of figure out what kind of dork you're going to be. And
right.
That was the kind of dork I was, being in choir and being in, you know, like plays in high school was comfortably, that made a lot of sense to me.
And it was
something I had, it gave me a lot of joy and everybody else who was involved in it a lot of joy. And it was, you know, it's good to experience joy, obviously.
Right.
But, you know, doesn't mean any of it is good or cool or, but then when I wound up through a somewhat circuitous route at the University of Washington, and I was, I had been writing for the school paper, speaking of lame, and I met a
man, you were just like a ball of lame.
Yeah, exactly. It's really true.
We should hang out.
A flaming ball of lame. But I met this guy, and we became really good friends right away, and he got invited to play drums for this band that was some other guys that had been at the paper years before, and they had started a band, and everybody, it was, you know, the early 90s in Seattle, everyone you met was in a band starting a band.
Yeah.
And I always thought that would be a fun thing to try.
So wait, are you still in Southern California at
no,
this point?
No, this is at the University of Washington.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, I missed that.
And so I went along with him to the first practice. I mean, he wanted to play drums, having never played drums before.
Mm-hmm.
And he played, you know, a snare drum on the floor, kind of on his knees, and a broken hi-hat cymbal turned upside down in a paint can. That was his drum kit. And I sang into a microphone plugged into a guitar amp.
Right,
And that was our first time playing with Harvey Danger, which is a band that already existed, a little bit. And they needed a singer and they needed a drummer. And so that's what we became. Evan Salt and I became the new guys in that band. And we struggled to find out some way of like making music together. None of us really knew how to do it. And
then
I suggested that we try and play What Goes On by the Velvet Underground, which we did. And it's just one of those songs that anyone can play.
Right.
And we played it for like what must have been 2 hours. that song.
Yeah.
And it was really fun. And it was so fun that we just kept doing it for 15 years off and on.
That's really cool. So that was, I guess, so the, that was kind of the first incarnation of Harvey Danger?
Yeah.
Or did they have like some other singer before you signed on?
They actually were a band for like a year before I was involved.
They were just a jam band?
Well, Jeff, the guitar player, no, they were, they could never, none of us could ever have been in a jam band. I mean, quite apart from whether you like that kind of music or not, none of us had that kind of skill.
Right.
But Jeff, the guitar player, would sort of scream sing on songs. But they, you know, they also played a lot of instrumentals and things like that.
Cool.
I never saw them without me in it. And I think that, you know, when we all, when we four all got together, that was kind of the beginning of anybody taking it seriously within the band. Outside the band, nobody took it seriously for much longer.
Yeah. So let's check. Let's check the facts of the Wikipedia page then. So, Harvey Danger. It says here Harvey Danger was founded in 1994.
That's when the first practices we did were in late 93. In fact, but I remember I went home to Nashville for Christmas that year in 93 and started telling my family that I think I was going to be asked to join this band.
Uh-huh.
And so in 94 they kind of officially invited me and Evan to be in the band.
Nice.
We were seeing each other, I guess, up until that point.
Yeah, yeah. And then so where at what point, so you guys were playing for a little while, at what point did it finally become like this real thing that you know, you guys were pursuing, or
well, it became.
Did you finish college? Did you go through college? And
I didn't graduate, but I did. Okay. I mean, I went through college, and the thing is, I would say that early '94. Our first show was in April of '94.
Okay,
it was April 21st. Where'd you guys play at? '94, in fact, the Lake Union Pub, which is no longer standing, which was a proper shithole. And Evan and I were both 20 years old, and so we weren't allowed in except to just walk to the, well, you would, it wasn't a stage, it was just like an area of the floor.
Right.
But walk to that spot, play, then walk out, and we had to watch the rest of the show kind of through a plate glass window in front of the place. Although we did sneak back in and get really drunk.
Yeah.
And then we all went out to Chinese food and Evan threw up. But
that's beside the point.
That's another story. It's for another podcast. but it was. I think by that time, by April of '94, we all kind of did that thing where you look at each other and you're like, "Wow, this really feels amazing."
Right.
And you know, that's such an important moment in any creative endeavor, because it's not when you're good; it's when it feels good to do it. And
we knew we had
tons of work to do to even figure out what the hell we were doing, but I think by that point we had figured out that it was going to be worth doing it. And then I think a couple months later was when I was living in a house in Ravenna. It's the same house that's on the cover of our first album, actually. I was living in that house, and all of the roommates were suddenly moving out within kind of a week of one another. They all said, I got a new place, or I'm graduating, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I...
Kind of normal college, college house.
Exactly the kind of thing that happens. Totally. So I called Jeff and Aaron and Evan, and I said, hey, why don't you guys all move into this house? And so we all moved in together and lived together like the monkeys for like 4 years.
Right, in
a couple of different houses. And that was when things really got... unbearable, but also, you know, serious.
I was actually going to ask that too. Cause like, I used to live with, you know, a bunch of guys in college, and you know, when you're in college, you kind of, you know, you're like this vagabond that just moves from house to house to house pretty much almost every year. You know, you're always, you're constantly moving out, and, lived with a bandmate, you know, just started. That's when we started hating each other, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's funny about love and hate and how they are in a way the very same emotion.
We were
I think uniquely, or maybe not uniquely, but we were especially not suited to being roommates, really.
Right.
The only thing we really had in common, the four of us, was that we really wanted to do the band. We really wanted the band to get good. Yeah. And we also were, you know, I think secretly, the mid-90s in Seattle was not a time when you would ever have expressed ambition openly.
Right,
Even privately, you wouldn't really express it, or you would have to sort of disclaim it in some way. But we also had this ambition that, like, our big ambition was that we really wanted to play at the Crocodile on a weekend. And be the headliner at the Crocodile on a weekend. That seemed like a real triumph. And it also seemed impossible to imagine it really happening at that time.
Yeah.
for us.
Well, I remember because I was in a band that is now defunct, but when, you know, my big thing, my super goal was to, you know, not even make it big, but just to be able to play at the Comet.
Yeah.
On Capitol Hill. You know, just one show. That's all I'm asking. And we did. Yeah. It was a Tuesday, and it was like at 1 o'clock in the morning. So
how did it feel when you achieved that goal?
Terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there was like five people there.
Yeah.
You know, and two of them, you know, we knew. So,
right. Right.
And the other three were in the other band that hadn't left yet. They were still packing up their gear. So,
yeah.
But yeah, that's, you know, it's those little triumphs when you're first, you know, kind of when you're doing music and stuff that,
yeah.
you really shoot for. Right.
I mean, I look back on that time as being really bittersweet, really, because we were really committed to the band mm-hmm. in a way that I don't think I could ever really be as committed to anything ever again.
Cause really?
there was the, you know, the, like when you're that age, 21, 22, whatever, you really have the option of being like, who cares if it fails or it can't fail or what, like you have the option of applying real naivete to what you're doing, you
right,
know,
right.
And just believing that you're immortal and believing that whatever you do is going to work out properly,
right, yeah,
if only
yeah.
to spite the people closest to you who say these dreams you have are paltry.
Right, right. Well, that's a huge part of it, actually, is
yeah.
like, you know, the spite aspect.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm going to show these people that I can do this.
Yeah.
Right?
And, that, you know, yeah. it's the bitter, I mean, it's that's the sweet part, and the bitter part is I wish we had worked even harder than we did, you know,
mm-hmm.
and pushed ourselves more, and, you know, but we were really, like, it was really like a little orphanage, our house.
Right.
None of us knew anything about anything. We were really like that had to do with what we were trying to do. We didn't
yeah.
know anything
yeah.
about being in a band. We didn't know anything about like music, not even as a business, but as a culture. We just knew that we were really excited about music. All of us for the first time in our lives after years of having music seem like this other country that was for other people that you never will have access to because
right,
you're not
right.
cool
yeah.
and you're not kind of in the know and you're not popular or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Suddenly the 90s was a, you know, a good time for people who had traditionally been really lame and really, you know, like as marginalized as you can be as sort of in a sort of like white middle class way.
Right, right. Yeah.
You know, suddenly enfranchised in rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
And
all of a sudden, super famous.
Well, then that happened.
Yeah,
next.
Yeah. Well, let's take our first musical break here, and we are going to hear something that was featured on $5 cover, Lynn Shelton's $5 cover. You may remember us talking with her a couple episodes ago, and you're good friends with Lynn, right?
Yeah.
And you co-wrote a movie with her. Is
yeah.
that correct?
My Effortless Brilliance is
right.
her second feature film, and I am the lead actor, and I co-wrote it.
Excellent, excellent. Which I have yet to see, and
so
I
you've
really...
been preparing for this.
Yeah, yeah. Oh man,
good
God,
to know.
You haven't made it until you have Sean Nelson give you a jab.
Well, I mean, you also interviewed Lynn, so I don't know kind of what you've been. There's only your apartment can only get so clean,
right? Right.
Surely
right.
you have time to watch our movie.
Good point. Point well taken.
Right.
Point well taken. Okay, so we're gonna hear "Circling the Airport," which is featured on $5 cover, right?
Yes, a very truncated version of it is in the last episode of $5 cover.
Gotcha.
So that might be
gotcha.
Nice to hear the whole thing.
All right. So here's "Circling the Airport" by Sean Nelson, and we will be right back.
Separation, you're right. There's nothing lower than a cheater, except perhaps the other side of the equation. You're probably right about the Rolling Stones, how they were never the same after Brian Jones. But if you grant me sticky fingers, I will help you let it bleed. You're right, I've kind of been circling. Right. small map when everything I need is here. I know you're right about the dismal scenes, where one of us always has to beg and plead, but I did not come here to argue, I swear. I came here to concede. We're tuned to our own exclusive frequency. The fingers above this term and drum. And if you think I could ever live without that sound, you couldn't be more wrong. You couldn't be more wrong.
All right, welcome back. You're sitting here with Mr. Sean Nelson, and let's kind of continue where we left off here. We were talking about kind of, you know, the 90s and what that kind of entailed for your band, Harvey Danger.
Yeah.
So at what point did you guys, did it hit for you guys? Did it, you know, you had one song, Flagpole Sitta, that kind of struck it big for you guys, right?
Yeah.
And you're giving me that look like, how many times do I need to talk about this one? But was there a point in time that you guys, you know, or what was the point in time that you guys kind of realized that this could be a real thing?
There was no missing it. You know, mm-hmm. we put out our first record on a very small label called the Arena Rock Recording Company that was run by one guy, and it did really like just fine for an indie, you know, release.
Mm-hmm.
in 97 it got really good reviews in the, you know, kind of college press, and did pretty good on college radio, and it was, you know, Flagpole said it was obviously like a standout song that people liked
mm-hmm.
the most on the record, but the whole record sort of got good notices, and that song was, I think, it was like number 21 or something on the KEXP, or no, I guess it was it
KCMU,
I think it was
right?
Still KCMU then, yeah. On the KCMU, like top 90 songs or records of the year,
right?
You know,
right.
Like had a very respectable showing for itself, and then there was this sense of like, so now what do we do? And we didn't know. And by that point, we'd been together for about 4 years, and we were not writing songs at a very steady clip. And there was a little bit of, I wouldn't say anticlimax with the first record, but the sense of like, okay, well, we did that, and our lives still feel basically the same.
Right.
By that point, we still hadn't achieved the goal that we had, which was playing the Crocodile as a headliner on a weekend, you know, that still seemed like we were maybe getting closer, but even the CD release show for that record was on a Wednesday night, you know,
right.
kind of thing. And yeah. it was, you know, we were getting pretty good. We played at the Crocodile a lot, but we played in town a lot, and we never really toured,
mm-hmm.
because we felt like going on tour when no one in the world had heard of us just felt like a strange use of time and resources.
Right,
couldn't
right.
afford it, frankly. Yeah. And then I took a month off at the end of 97 or early 98. We had a particularly disastrous show in Portland in around November of 97. Uh-huh. I remember it really vividly. And at the end,
What made it a disaster? Just how you guys played, or what?
Well, yeah, how we played was a big part of it.
Yeah.
There were seven people there another part of it. And it was just this sort of like, you have a moment when you're in a band sometimes you have several moments like this where you're like, why are we playing the shows? You know, you
right,
get to a
right.
point where you can do it, and you can, you know, you sort of become one of the bands that sort of mm-hmm. fills the slots that are available.
Yeah, and you basically just power through. Right?
Yeah, but like, then the question of like, what not what are you working towards, but why?
Yeah, what's the point? What's the point of playing for seven people who don't even give a shit?
Yeah, the futility aspect of it really became painful to me. And I remember very specifically the Flagpole Sitta was acutely just agonizing to get through that night. And we messed it up. And it was just a bad show. And on the way back, you know, I drove back with Jeff for, you know, the whole 3 hours of the way back. We drove back after the show. And I was like, we're never playing that song again. No more shows. Like, let's just, you know what? Let's just break up. Let's just break up the band because we don't need to even do the band anymore because there's no reason to do it.
And this was what, like 1998 or something?
This was 97.
Oh, 97.
November of 97.
Okay.
And he was like, I totally agree. No, I totally agree. We need to, that's absolutely what we're going to do. So I actually took a month or so off from the band, and I was in a play that was sort of wasn't that great of an experience, but like I had a role in a play and I thought, okay, I'm going to do this and not do the band and we'll take a month. And then at the end of this month, we're going to get back together and decide whether it's worth keeping on doing the band.
Right.
Because we were never very prolific. We didn't have a bunch of other songs, and the songs on the record were already a year or two old by that point. And that's all we had to play. And so that really sucked. And so during that month, kind of at the beginning of that month, I handed the CD to a DJ at the end who lived directly across the street from where I worked at The Stranger. And I saw him on the street, and I had a copy of our record with me, as I always did, really. And then I gave it to him, and I was like, hey, I don't know if you want it or anything, but here's this record, and you know, play it. And it, you know, and honestly, like, he took it to the radio station, he put it on the radio, and within, I don't know, 2 weeks or 3 weeks or something, it was the number one song on the radio station, the most requested. It got added to heavy rotation. It was like all this stuff happened in this incredibly lucky, organic way, but the song, in the music business, they would say that the song reacted. And so it was obviously that, you know, there were tons of radio stations, commercial stations in the country that took their cue from what The End in Seattle was doing. And one of them was K-Rock in LA.
Yeah.
And then K-Rock started playing it. And because they started playing it, all the radio stations in America started playing it that were in this format. And and at that point, I'm like, you know, acting in a play in front of, you know, six people at a, you know, in a theater in a mall, you know? And so it was like, I think that maybe we should keep doing the band. and I started getting phone calls from record labels every day.
Really?
And I started getting like 20 phone calls from record labels every day.
So what does that feel like for, you know, for a band that's like you said, like, I mean, on the verge of just breaking up, and then all of a sudden all this this heap of shit just gets piled on to your shoulders, so to speak, you know, where it's like, you know, okay, now you have, all of a sudden now you have some real decisions to make.
You know?
And it's got to be exciting, right?
It was great. It was terrifying because we didn't know anything and we thought we knew everything, but we didn't know one important thing.
Right.
So we had ignorance.
Did you have anybody, any friend, like bands that were playing around Seattle at that time? You know, I mean, it was a very strange time. The 90s for Seattle was very strange because it was just like, no matter what kind of band you were in, it was just like, they wanted you, right?
Well, I heard that from a lot of people, but we were in a band for a good 4 years and nobody wanted us.
Okay.
And nobody, like our friends, the people we had made friends with were all in kind of marginal bands also that nobody knew about and nobody cared about. And we were in a ghetto and we lucked into writing a song and with the help of John Goodmanson recording it in such a way that it was like really appealing to a lot of people, but it wasn't like the band was ever that appealing to a lot of people. It was that song. Always.
It was that song. Yeah.
And you know, we encountered a lot of resentment from people in our, I mean, I would even hesitate to call it a community, but our group of bands.
Right.
Because they all, you know, they all wanted that too, somehow.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody kind of wanted something like that. Everybody wants to be discovered in some way.
Right.
Despite the prevailing notion that people
didn't want that, but I think people did. Mm-hmm. We certainly did. We didn't admit it, though.
Yeah.
We didn't even admit it when it was happening, which was, you know, much to our chagrin. But once we started kind of getting people, like our name suddenly was kind of everywhere, and then people who were a little more famous and well-known started acknowledging us and me a lot mm-hmm. more. Mm-hmm. And I asked a couple of them for advice, but I didn't take it. You know, the advice was always get as much money as you can up front, you know, because right, you're never right. going to get paid again.
Right.
And I wish I had listened to that advice. But, you know, it was an amazing, you know, absolutely once in a lifetime
right,
thing,
right.
but it was also really embarrassing in its way too, because of the dominant culture of, you know, like false or enforced humility
right,
in rock band culture at that
yeah,
time.
Yeah. Well, especially in Seattle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think mostly in Seattle.
Right.
But yeah. I've now, to paraphrase the song, I've now been around the world, and I have discovered that was a phenomenon that really didn't exist in most other places. In most other places, if you get success, you're just psyched. You know,
yeah,
he was really
yeah, totally,
excited.
Totally.
And we really were gripped with a kind of shame about it. But it's not like we turned it down either.
Right. And I read an article. I may have not watched your movie, but I read an article that somebody in New York did with you a couple of years ago. I think it was right before Harvey Danger's last show.
Right.
And you had stated that. What you had just said, that it was like, you know, in Seattle, everybody kind of knew who you were and everything, and, you know, knew of your other songs also, other than Flagpole Sitta.
Well, the right. people who came to see us play did.
Right,
you know,
right.
By that time, we had a little audience. I mean, we would play for, like, there were probably 100 to 200 people who
yeah,
would come out
yeah.
and see us play.
But it wasn't like if you went on tour, then, like, once Flagpole Sitta kind of, you know, hit, like, you know, when you guys went on tour, it wasn't that way around the rest of the country?
No, God, no. I mean, yeah. it really was the case that, you know, we were on tour for almost 9 months
mm-hmm.
in 1998, about 9 months. And that was the first touring we'd ever done, so we were really pretty exhausted.
Right.
And we had this conception of ourselves as, like, a band with, you know, a small body of work, but, like, a body of work and an
right,
album.
Right. Yeah.
And in fact, the conception of us in the world was that song that happens to be done by those guys, you know?
Uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
so it's truly, I think it was the case that had we gone out and just played Flagpole, you know, 10 times in a row, most of the people who came to most of our shows would have been thrilled.
Right.
I mean,
there were
people at every show who would sing along to every song. And, mm-hmm. and I mean, I later discovered what it means to reach so many people. As we did with it. I mean, we had a hit song and then that sort of the period ended and the song kind of was put out to its pasture and it's now like an evergreen song that once was a hit.
Right, right.
And the rest of our stuff will never be exposed to that many people ever. But being exposed to so many people means that a certain number of those people, and it's, you know, a relatively tiny percentage, but those people interacted with and listen to the rest of our stuff in a really interesting way. And they, and
right,
they sort of,
right.
those are the people we wound up kind of being face to face with yeah, on the yeah. second and third album.
Yeah. And now, so some years passed, you guys have finally, you played your last show
yes.
in 2009.
Yeah.
And you know, I wasn't that familiar with your music when Harvey Danger was doing their thing.
How old are you?
I am 30.
Okay.
So yeah, I'm a bit younger.
Right.
A bit younger. But I have recently become a fan of yours because they do, you know, KXP mm-hmm. is a great station here in Seattle. And if
yes.
you don't know what we're talking about, you should check it out. It's 90.3 KXP, KXP.org. You can find them on the web and stream them. All over the world, and they are a great, great radio station. But they kind of introduced me back into Harvey Danger, mm-hmm. where, you know, they play a lot of your, the full catalog,
yeah.
you know, of songs that you guys have had. And I got to say, like, I enjoy it. I really enjoy it. Yeah.
KEXP, you know, well, KEXP used to be KCMU, which started in the same building as Harvey Danger, the communications building. CMU was the name of the communications building, the abbreviation at the University of Washington.
Oh, okay.
And we used to, I mean, the original Harvey Danger used to actually rehearse in that building. But KCMU was the first place that ever, first radio station that ever played us.
Mm-hmm.
Cheryl Waters was the producer of the first show we ever played on live.
Really?
In 1995, I think, or 96, the Live Room. John Richards was an intern at that time. You know, when we first were making music. And, like, those people... And I later worked at KEXP.
You hosted Audio Oasis.
Yeah, I was one of the hosts of the local show. And so we have an incredibly rich and fulfilling history with those folks. Mm-hmm. And so when we put out subsequent records, we always talked to them about it, and they kind of were on board and thought of us as a, they thought of us as a band, whereas the, you know, the commercial stations that made us, you know, like, well, famous and, you know, popular for 3 minutes and 20 seconds at a time, those people don't remember us even, you know, they didn't remember us the minute the song was over.
Yeah.
And we, the thing is, we knew that even then.
Uh-huh. Sorry, it's my coffee maker.
Was that your bullshit detector?
Somebody's lying.
I mean it. I love them. I really am grateful to all the folks that came.
Yeah, but have you seen kind of a resurgence in the popularity of Harvey Danger? Because they're still, I mean, you guys are still on rotation at that radio station.
We're not. Well, I mean, they have a few. There are a few songs that they play. Yeah. Like we're definitely part of part of their catalog that they don't let get too dusty. And it's nice. And, you know, every once in a while someone comes up to me and says, hey, I heard your song on the radio. And I think, oh, God. And then they're like, no, it was on KEXP. And I think, oh, well, that's great.
Oh, okay, great.
Really
great.
Nice. And it is nice. I mean, having your music played on the radio is such a privilege. You're so lucky whenever anybody does it, even Flagpole, it's still like, okay, that one doesn't mean quite as much because it's sort of part of a catalog that, you know, like, because you're right up against all these other songs and you think of it, that whole world as sort of, you know, disposable pop trash. You know, the other thing is that you meet people, like the KEXP thing is a big deal for me personally, and they've been great to us, but there's also the thing of like, well, in particular, when I was in that band, The Long Winters, kind of in between, like Harvey Danger took a 3-year hiatus where we were sort of broken up. In fact, we were broken up, but then we got back together. But I was in this band, The Long Winters, and we went on tour. We toured quite a lot. And at almost every show, someone would come up to me and be like, the first Harvey Danger album is the first album I ever got when I was in sixth grade, and it introduced me to this whole world of music that I now love, and I will always be very grateful. Like,
what do you say to something like that too? Like, I mean, that's got to just make you feel awesome.
It does.
Right.
It does.
But boy, I mean, does that put you,
you can only, you can only say thank you.
Yeah.
You know, you can only say, thank you for telling me, you know?
Yeah.
At the time I honestly was like, well, that was a wasted life. That was a life lived for absolutely nothing. And then, you know, you have to find satisfaction somewhere in yourself. But the finding out that you have, you know, had a meaning, just been like some part of people's lives musically, the way music has affected your life, is like, that actually is why you do it. That sort of what it's for, far more than money, which you never really make.
far more
than fame, which doesn't actually exist. And far more than, you know, sort of the rock and roll lifestyle, which is a drag in a lot of ways,
even though it's
fun in a lot of ways too. You know, I certainly was always just a very unlikely rock figure. And I always really liked that. That was an exciting thing to me. But I always wanted that thing that that basically everybody who makes rock and roll music wants, which is just to just to matter, you know, to people who are listening in a real way. And we discovered through being really mainstream for a really short amount of time that, you know, the wide audience is something that you could never imagine.
You could never
imagine those people's lives. But you then wind up being a part of it. And yeah, sometimes they come up to you and, as represented in the movie $5 cover, they say, I got my tongue pierced because of you and your song. And then sometimes they say, I was going to kill myself and I didn't because your music helped me through it. And neither of those things is like ultimately a validation of your life, but they each in their way, you feel like you've contributed something to the world you live in that isn't bullshit, you know?
Because
our songs, almost without exception, our songs were things that all of us really felt and meant, you know? It was not there. We did not have the skill to be calculating, you know? We only could write what we could write, and we really meant it. And so to have other people, feel it, be affected by it, or even just like it, you know, it's great.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's say that's a great spot to take our second musical break here. When we come back, we're going to talk with you about kind of life after Harvey Danger. And then hopefully get into...
What do we do for the next 30 seconds?
Oh, boy. Yeah. And we'll talk a little bit about how you got hooked up with Lynn Shelton and doing these movies with
her. Okay. I never hooked up with Lynn Shelton.
Well, yeah. Yeah. You know what I'm saying.
For the record.
Come on.
She's happily married.
Should we get a rim shot in there somewhere?
If you insist.
Here we go. Yeah, there we go. Okay. So we will be right back with Sean, more from Sean Nelson, and we are going to hear "The World Owes Me a Living."
Do you want to maybe do the Harvey Danger song? Just since we've been
Yeah. Let's do that. And this was kind of the last song that you guys ever recorded.
We wrote this for our last tour, which was in the summer of 2009.
Okay,
and we were surprised by how well it turned out, so we decided to record it.
Oh, excellent!
Then we put it out in late 2010. It's on our website. It's on harveydanger.com.
Right, and you can download it for free, right?
Yeah, along with a couple of other records.
Excellent. Okay, and this is "The Show Must Not Go On" by Harvey Danger, and we will be right back.
Thank you.
Okay, we're back with Sean Nelson, and we kind of left off, kind of ending the topic of Harvey Danger, and we're going to move on to
Once and For All.
It's done. This is the podcast that ends everything.
Excellent.
Yeah, we are.
That would be a good T-shirt. I don't want to be your marketing department, but.
I gave you the Air Raid mug too, so you're sipping out of the Air Raid mug. Yeah.
I would like to say that I could identify all three of the pop culture things that you have in your intro.
Wonderful. You want to list them off right now?
A mug. Well, there's Step Brothers.
Yeah, Step Brothers.
Dazed and Confused.
Yep.
And then Dinosaur Jr.
Dinosaur Jr. Very good.
Boom.
Boom. Boom, sir.
Two 90s and an early 2000s.
Right. Very good. Very good. Thank you very much. So after Harvey Danger kind of ended, you joined another group called The Long Winters. I'm very sorry. I'm actually a big fan.
I'm actually a big fan.
Yeah, you can tell. Yeah. I even didn't watch your movie.
Right.
Were you a co-founder of Barsook Records?
Barsook Records existed, and then I became a partner around 2001.
Gotcha. Had that been something that you always kind of wanted to do or something like that?
Not exactly, but they were really good friends of mm-hmm. mine. And there was basically this opportunity arose to buy a studio that was the studio where we made the first Harvey Danger record. And mm-hmm. a studio that had a lot of history in it. It was John and Stu's place for a time, and that's where, I mean, Slater Kinney made Dig Me Out, and I mean, there were just there was a lot of sort of classic mid-period Northwest albums were made in there. And then before that, it was Reciprocal Recording, which is where, you know, Nirvana made Bleach and Soundgarden made all their early recordings. So it was just like this amazing room that was going to be...
A lot of history.
Yeah. But then it became this thing that we were going to get so that Death Cab had done... they had done their second album, We Have the Facts and We're Voting Yes, kind of in the same way they made their first one, which was in a, you know, like basically a home recording kind of situation. And then the idea was to get this studio so that Chris Walla, who was the, you know, producer arm of Death Cab, could learn how to use a bigger studio, and so that would ideally make them better able to make more ambitious records. And so I kind of kicked in some money for that effort to happen, mm-hmm. and that led to them making the Photo album and also Transatlanticism. And I just, you know, I was just happy to be part of. I mean, I was already sort of part of the family of Barsook, but it was nice to kind of be part of the. Part of the company also.
Yeah.
And there were, I mean, that turned into a period where Barsook really grew from being a fledgling thing to being something where a lot of really good albums came out. And The Long Winters came out of that time as well. But also like Not a Surf, Let Go came out around that time. And I was really, and John Vanderslice's first few records and
right.
you know, Sunset Valley, and I'm of course just spacing on others, but it was like a really, I think of it as kind of the golden age of Barsook, even though there's plenty of argument for now being the golden age of Barsook.
Yeah, well, I was looking at the catalog yesterday on the internet while I was doing my research.
Good.
Okay,
I'm glad you used the internet.
Yeah. I barely know how to use
Wikipedia,
it. Actually, that's why I have you here. Will you show me how? No. But yeah, there's a ton of, like we were talking about before we started the show, that you guys are re-releasing the Dismemberment Plan, Emergency and I, on vinyl. And you've also got Fanagram's on there too, which is, that's a great album.
Yeah.
Just a ton of great music on that label.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, and do you, what? So
I
what
don't do I don't do anything?
You
I
don't
no,
do anything.
I have there. No, I have yeah. no practical involvement, and I never have. And I just am sort of like part of the inner circle, and I, you know, like.
Are you more of an investor?
Well, it, I mean, for the I did. Company I mean, or something? I put some money into it, but it was no. It's just more like one. There's just really one person who kind of makes all the meaningful decisions there, and I sometimes whisper things in his ear, and there's a bunch of other people who influence him as well. Tons of other people who actually do all the work around there. I don't mean to say it's a one person operation, there's sort of nothing for me to do there, because I don't know anything about, I don't know anything about running a record label.
Could you do like A&R or something and go out and
there's sort of no need for
check bands out and stuff.
I mean, there was a time when I was a lot more avid about checking out new music.
Right.
And I would always, send it over Barsuk's way. But it's there's just sort of one person who kind of does all that there.
Right. Right.
And that's probably how it ought to be.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how other labels work. I don't know. The other thing is that as years have gone by, I'm increasingly not at all interested in the music business.
And
following new bands, and I still love music, but I just don't really keep up with it anymore. And being a label person, you really have to keep up with things.
Yeah. So I mean, since you've then come into kind of like a writing aspect, you've written a book about a Joni Mitchell album, right? And
it's not quite a. It's like a book. It's like a bookling.
It's like a cliff notes, maybe.
It's a short book. It's a pamphlet.
Okay.
But it was still very hard to do.
Yeah, yeah. And then you co-wrote this movie with Lynn Shelton, My Effortless Brilliance, and starred in.
Yes.
And so is that kind of becoming like your new thing that you like to do, or?
Yeah, that's definitely kind of
your new passion.
That's the thing that I'm most interested in pursuing and learning how to do better. And I wrote another film with my friend Steven earlier. Well, I guess it was it was almost exactly 1 year ago that we started shooting it.
Uh-huh.
And the whole year before that, we were kind of working on it. And then we've been editing it for a year. So in 5 years, maybe you can see it. But we wound
what's
up...
What's the title?
It's called Treatment.
Okay.
We... Steven and I co-directed it, and I wrote the screenplay, and I act in it, and there's a bunch of other really... Well, there's a lot of really good actors in it.
Uh-huh.
It's almost done. I'd say it's about 95% of the way there.
Cool. What's it about?
It's about a guy who he's like a frustrated screenwriter. He's sort of more like a wannabe screenwriter.
Uh-huh.
He's getting on in years, and he has a chance.
This is an autobiography.
No, it's not at all. He has a chance encounter with a movie star, kind of an A-list movie star, in a bar, and winds up checking himself into a celebrity rehab clinic under false pretenses to try and become better friends with this movie star.
Just to kind of shadow this guy.
Well, yeah, he wants the guy to be in his movie, but of course the truth is that there is no movie for him to be in. He just wants to be around him.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of like an entourage situation. Huh?
A little bit. Yeah. A little bit like that.
Well, that sounds really interesting. I'd like to see that. Hopefully you can send something our way letting us know that it's out.
Well, I think that your track record with watching my work is not necessarily making me run to show.
Hey, wait a minute. Hold on. We watched all the whole $5 cover series and everything, which was very, very good, by the way.
I had nothing to do with it. I just showed up and I wrote my scenes and I acted in it. That was it.
You actually wrote your scenes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, those scenes, like my little arc is sort of, I mean, Lynn goes around to everybody and says, what should we do?
Right. Right.
And then you sort of collaborate on it together. And then there's a lot of improvisation. But my arc was based on, it's not, you wouldn't call it autobiographical exactly, because it's sort of fake autobiographical, or it's like fiction. The way you think of the way I always imagine that a fiction writer sort of turns his or her life into just the more kind of narratively interesting version of that life. So it starts with me, writing a song with my friend Jacob, who the first song that we played today, Jacob Hoffman, he wrote the music, and I wrote the words and the melody. He sent me this track, And when I wrote the words and stuff to it, I hadn't written a song for a long time, and I sort of was feeling like, oh, well, maybe that's it. Maybe that's all she wrote, fellas. But I wrote the stuff for that right away. I just came out in a hurry, and it was a great feeling. Mm-hmm. And then you know, the rest of my little arc in the web show and $5 cover was that I go looking for my friend Ryan to sort of play it for her, because she had also been, this is not in the show, but she had also been in a band that had broken up, and she was just starting to get on her feet making
right,
music.
Right.
And so we had that in common. That was like, a lot of our friendship was based on having gone through that, a similar experience, and obviously not the same, but you know, so we were like friendly in that way. And so I'm looking for her in the show to play it for her, but I keep sort of finding that I can't get to her, and I get kind
right,
of assaulted
right.
by Harvey Danger, two rabid
fans,
Harvey
and,
Danger fans,
yeah. at her show,
at
right?
Her show,
yeah, yeah.
Which is, I mean, it's funny, but like that is the most autobiographical thing in the whole bit for me.
Right,
like that,
right.
that kind of thing has happened to me many times, and it's always strange and slightly embarrassing, and,
right.
and like you yeah. don't, you just, there's no response to it except to leave.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And so
that was a really funny scene, by the way.
I agree. Those guys, you know, the guys, Vinnie Smith is one of the actors. He's sort of the uh-huh. more, he's the one who's like a little scarier.
He's the guy that comes
solemn.
Up and goes, you know, I'm a drummer.
No, that's Kevin Hamadani.
Oh, okay. You're talking about the quiet guy. That's
yeah,
just like
the quiet guy who looks like he might actually wind up killing me.
Right.
And I'm wearing a little pin that is an aluminum cast of, the you know
the record,
the adapter
yeah,
that you put in a
yeah.
45,
mm-hmm.
and he looks at it and he's like, "It means eternal life, doesn't it?"
Yeah, right.
I mean, he's that guy is really, really funny and a really good friend, and he's the sound man on the show.
Oh yes, oh, okay,
and
okay.
On My Effortless Brilliance, also
he did
all
great in that little bit part.
And
that
then
was,
Kevin,
that was awesome.
Kevin is a filmmaker who's from mm-hmm. here, and he made a movie called Zombies of Mass Destruction, which is on Netflix. I can't believe you haven't seen it.
Well,
I've
will
seen
now.
It. It's very
I
funny.
Will now.
And then he just made a movie this summer or like late fall that I acted in with my friend Basil, who I'm in My Effortless Brilliance with. And so the snake eats its tail, and everybody does everybody else's movie, and it's good.
Right,
it's good
right. Well, and so how did you get together with Lynn Shelton? How did you guys first meet?
Well, we first met because we were in a musical together for one night.
Really?
At the Empty Space Theater that was written by my friend Herbert Bergel, who is a kind
Is that
of
a real name or is that a pen name?
It is, I mean, it's not the name he was born with.
Okay.
But it is a very real
Herbert
name.
Bergel?
He's a very real, it's a very real name to those of us who understand how great
that
Herbert
is. Awesome.
Is. Yeah, Herbert is he had a band called Rat Cat Hogan that that Harvey Danger brought to, they played many Harvey Danger shows with us, and I sing on their records. And,
mm-hmm.
And in fact, the only time I ever got the misbegotten illusion that I wanted to have a record label was when I put out a Rat Cat Hogan 7-inch, and put out is really in quotes, but he had a musical called The Gas Man, and Lynn was in that and I was in it, and so we kind of, you know, we met each other then, and then I knew her because she was editing my friend Paul Willis's movie, and then she was making a movie called We Go Way Back, and she asked me to help her with the music, kind of like being the music supervisor of sorts.
Uh-huh,
I didn't really know how to do that, but
yeah.
And then we wound up having a lot of conversations through that period, and she got really excited about making another movie, and she asked me if I wanted to kind of not only be in it but be sort of the central figure of it, like that somehow that it would, she was going to start the process by making a character with me and then build the movie around it.
Mm-hmm,
and so that's
mm-hmm.
what we did. And it was like, I don't know. I mean, I think the movie is really good. I really like it. But it's a very personal thing. And it was also something that I had secretly always, always wished that someone would say to me, you know, that
right,
I want
right.
you to be in this movie. And,
yeah.
And so it's definitely a situation where like, I would follow Lynn into hell for that. Like, there's nothing I would not do for her.
Right, right.
Because of that experience.
Yeah. And it seems like, I mean, she does movies a bit differently, too. Like, most of her movies, too, are more centered around a little bit, or more of, you know, kind of loose scripts.
Yeah.
And
yes, loose scripts is a generous way of saying. Well, I mean, it's there.
Like, sometimes there's no script.
Well, there's a script. I mean, there's like an outline, really.
Yeah.
But then you kind of do, you improvise your dialogue, and you kind of improvise. You find the scenes as you're doing them, which is, I have discovered, a very uncommon way of doing things, and it's really hard and it's really kind of specific. But she really likes working that way.
Uh-huh.
Because she finds that it really highlights the specific things about the actor,
right?
That no writer can really kind of showcase.
Yeah.
I don't know if she'll always make movies that way, but she's made a few like that. Hump Day was her kind of big successful one,
right?
I know she's just finished shooting a new one, and $5 Cover is that way too, you know.
Yeah, and it—I mean, it seemed like, and this is something that I mentioned to her in our kind of pseudo, like she does, you know, quote unquote loose scripts. We do quote unquote loose podcasting.
Yes,
you know. So
I can't believe that you haven't been the hit of the toast of the Sundance Film Festival. The way Lynn Shelton has.
You just wait. Yeah. You just wait.
I know, I am.
I think I asked her about that. You know, it just makes things seem so much more real, right? And like, when in $5 Cover, when I first heard about it, I was like, oh boy, how's this going to go? Because she's using a lot of people that are playing themselves,
right?
You know, acting for the first time. And it worked really well in that set. It works really well in that setting. Somebody who's not really trained as a Dustin Hoffman,
right,
per se. You know?
I think if you take away, I mean, it's now not uncommon for bands to be on camera a lot.
Right.
Whereas 10 years ago, it was really unusual to be on camera very much.
Right.
Certainly, you wouldn't have like video podcasting on your own band website. It was just that it just simply wasn't a part of your language. So there's a little bit more of a sense of bands knowing how to be themselves on camera, mm-hmm. or how mm-hmm. to kind of perform the role of themselves. But the good thing about $5 Cover, I think, well, one of many good things about it, is that you take away, or it takes away the, it puts them on camera, it sort of takes away the necessity of them doing something interesting or fun,
right.
Or like,
yeah, totally.
They can just kind of behave. And so I don't know if it's real, but it's definitely more natural. And it kind of like, because Lynn is like, her secret weapon is that she's an editor at heart. And then she also works with this amazing editor, Nat Sanders. They work together, and they really know how to find the moments that are really revealing and that are sort of whatever, you know, they find those true moments or those dramatic moments or those funny moments. And so it makes the whole process, like you wind up, I don't know, it's because they're shooting on video and they're able to do long takes. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mindfulness Brilliance, it was not at all uncommon for there to be a single take that would be like 60 minutes long, and they wind up actually using 3 minutes of it or 90 seconds of it or whatever.
Yeah.
But
like, when you say something like that too, you're talking about like a whole scene where it's just like you and another person talking or something like that.
Yeah. I mean,
it's
like
ad lib,
the way you and I are sitting here.
Right.
Talking,
right.
There would be two cameras, sometimes three cameras pointing at us.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it winds up in what winds up in the movie is when you sort of, you know, when you take your headphones off and are like, what the fuck is that sound?
You know, like, right, right.
That's the only thing that winds up happening, but we have to have this whole conversation to get to that moment.
Yeah.
And so it is a bold approach to doing it, but it requires a certain amount of confidence that something good will happen.
Right, right. Yeah.
And I think generally it really does pay off.
Yeah. Well, see, I mean, it seems to have. I mean, she did really well with Hump Day.
Yes.
Both me and Mairead are very big fans of that movie. And we were big, like I said, big fans of $5 Cover. When we felt really important too, because MTV, like, you know, gave us the pass to watch that stuff
before it came out.
You know, everything like that. So,
well, they did a really, like, the, I wasn't sure because it was finished a long time ago, and I didn't know when it would come out or if it would.
Right,
come
it's
out.
Like it's like a year old, right?
Yeah, I mean, before I'm sure most of the bands have broken up, or but. They did such an amazing job with that website and the, like,
oh, I know,
the graphics, yeah. Yeah. And like every little thing about it is so kind of pleasing and excellent. And,
right, right.
And I don't know if you saw the one they made for the Memphis music.
I did
scene,
not watch that one yet.
Good Lord. No. It's, I mean,
not as good.
I would hurry and watch My Effortless Brilliance before I saw that one. If I were you. That's all I'm going to say on that subject.
Well, okay. I'm telling you right now that I'm going to write down
Zombies of Mass Destruction.
And I'm writing down
Kevin Hamadani.
My Effortless Brilliance also, because we're going to watch those.
Yes.
Soon. Yeah. And this makes for great fake radio too, because
yeah.
Just me writing.
If you could see him, he's pretend writing.
Yeah. Still writing. Okay. Well, Sean, it's been a real pleasure having you on here. What are you doing now? What can we expect to see from you? Are you playing any shows? Doing anything?
I'm not really doing music right now. Uh-huh. I have very much. I'm singing at. Well, when is this going to go live?
This is going to go live on Sunday.
Oh my goodness! Well, on on the 21st of January, I'm singing at this place called The Abbey in Fremont with a bunch of really talented singers. It's just an a cappella show. Everybody's just singing a cappella, which means without instruments,
yeah.
in Italian. Or is it Latin? Or are those, in fact, the same thing?
Getting back to your choir roots.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Shaking off my nerd dust. and then, well, the night before that, actually, speaking of nerd, the night before that at the Sorrento Hotel, I'm interviewing the playwright Wallace Shawn, who most people are familiar with only because he was in like The Princess Bride,
right,
and the
right.
movie Clueless, but yeah. He's a great playwright and actor, and
he's the fast talker, the yeah. smart guy.
Yes, yeah. So I'll be interviewing him live in front of an audience at the Sorrento Hotel.
Oh, that'll be really cool.
And then that's all. I guess that's all I have for like live things. I have a couple of records that are basically finished that I
mm-hmm.
may or may not release.
Well, and that's what we're going to hear next, right? To kind of bring us out.
Yes.
Or wait, are we? Wait, which one do you want to? Which one do you want to play? We've got
I don't
care. World Owes Me a Living, and I Intend to Collect. Or do you want to play the Gotta Get Up?
Well, I guess for copyright reasons, we should do my song. Because then you won't have to get in
right.
any trouble from the Harry Nilsson estate.
Thank you very much.
Yes, always thinking of you. And then, you know, Treatment, the movie, is nearly finished, and we submitted it to film festivals, so I hope
oh,
it gets
excellent.
Into some of those.
Is it going to be in SIFF? Have you heard back from SIFF yet?
We haven't submitted to SIFF yet. The deadline oh, okay. isn't until next month.
Oh, wonderful.
And then, you know, Stephen and I are going to make another movie, I think.
Excellent.
And then,
excellent.
I don't know. I don't know what else. I should probably get a job at some point. It's been a couple of years.
Well, it sounds like you're a busy guy. I mean, you got a lot going on.
I do. Well, yeah. I try to keep busy because if you're busy, then you can't pay attention to to how sad you are all the time.
I find you very pleasant.
Thank you.
And it's anytime really sweet. you want to come back on this show, we would love to have you.
All
and
right.
I've had a lot,
you
of,
say that
a lot
now.
Of fun talking with
Look,
you.
Look, I'm not going to be your sidekick, if that's what you're suggesting.
Come on, Sean. You know
third,
you want to.
Third
you've
banana.
Had, you've had so much fun today.
I have. It's true.
Yeah.
I haven't had this much fun in... up around this part of Aurora, certainly for
you can call it what
months.
It is. We call it Ahura
yeah.
up here.
Who was one of my favorite characters on the original Star Trek?
Yeah,
but yeah, it's a good show and a fine environment.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for coming. And so we're going to play, we're going to go out with The World Owes Me a Living and I Intend to Collect. And can we get this anywhere?
No.
No?
Certainly not.
No? I mean, All right. Well, you can only hear it on Airwave.
It's on what may be my debut solo album, if that
comes out. Okay, great. Well, you heard it here first, folks. I got to quit saying that, man. I'm so sick of that. It always just comes up, though.
With the word folks, or you heard it
here first? No, no, you heard it. You heard it here first.
I think that's a good slogan. Maybe you can put it on the back of the
T-shirt. It just sounds so contrived. Yeah, I'll put it on the back of the... No, we'll make hoodies.
There you go.
And we'll put it on the hood. Like, yeah. Yeah, okay.
But well, have you considered maybe doing like a Ku Klux Klan hoodie kind of thing that goes all the way over the face?
We could try something like that.
I'm just spitballing.
You just you're just throwing ideas. I mean, that's what you do.
Yes.
You're an idea man.
That's right. That's all I can do.
Well, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you.
Everybody, you can find our show. Please visit our website, www.air-raid.net. You can now find us on iTunes, Zune Marketplace, Stitcher, and of course, on Facebook and Twitter, at Air Raid Net. So please, 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 please send us your emails, and, you know, ideas for shows and everything like that. Oh, that's one thing I forgot about. Did you want to answer this question that the listener sent in?
I can't remember the question.
Okay. Let's so this is from listener Kelly here in Seattle. She is a big fan of yours. She wants to marry you. And also she says, just tell him I'm the girl that during his Q&A period of Harvey Danger's last show ever, I asked him if he had ever jacked off to anything animated. And so do you want to answer that question? Have you jacked off to anything animated?
Well, I mean, you're going to have to define animated. I mean, does that include The Living? Anything that's living is animated in a way.
Right. I mean, that's what I was just saying.
Certainly never a cartoon.
I think that's a good answer.
I mean, they're all animated.
Yeah.
All of them.
All your masturbatory conquests.
Yes.
Everybody's, actually, for that matter.
That's probably not true.
Well.
Not every. I'm sure people masturbate to the dead.
Yeah.
And I don't mean the Grateful Dead.
No. No.
Although they would be.
Isn't there a word for that? Isn't that?
Necrophilia is actually having sex with them, but fantasizing about crypto necrophilia.
Maybe.
Pseudo necrophilia.
Yeah. That's a great way to end a show, isn't it?
Yeah, there's your slogan for your hoodie, for your...
There you go. Going on the back of the Ku Klux Klan hoodie.
Yep.
Great. Right, we just lost all of our black listeners.
We're all going to be millionaires.
Yeah. All right, thanks a lot, Sean. And we will see you next week with the guys from Explone and Kirby Crackle and the dudes that put on the Emerald City Comic Con. We're going to be making beer with all those guys. And we will see you next week.
Nobody listens very well. They only want to tell you when you're being self-destructive. Nobody understands the pressure you are under. No wonder why you aren't more productive. Never had the means or the wherewithal. Shit down.